Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staber, a show where we bring you at least three different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our first topic this hour is electoral misinformation. As America gears up for another presidential election, so are people across the globe who want to influence what we think about the candidates, the issues, and even whether we vote at all. It's not exactly new, but the rise of artificial intelligence will make 2024 very different from 2020. Here to help us walk through how misinformation might spread and how we can effectively fight back is journalist Sasha Eisenberg. He's the author of a new book called The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook in the Disinformation Age. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Anna. Great to be here.
Let's start with the 2008 campaign and those now infamous emails questioning whether Barack Obama was an American citizen. Why are those emails an important stop on this misinformation highway?
So it was the first time that we saw sort of viral misinformation in the online age. Obviously, there's always been lying in politics. There's always been rumor, word of mouth. But what we started to see in 2008 was that the internet afforded any voter who didn't necessarily have access to a newspaper or radio station the ability to spread news, true or false. And, you know, those were basically chain letters. But what we saw just from the technological shift going from a print chain letter where you would have needed access to a mimeograph machine and a big book of stamps, now people could hit forward on a letter. And that spread quickly, but it seems obviously incredibly quaint when compared to what social media now allows people to do.
And you write that it was the first time that political campaigns, major campaigns like presidents, had to think through how to quantify a threat like this, because it wasn't a media ad buy by an opponent. It wasn't a bad article in, say, the New York Times. This was like a bunch of chain emails circulating amongst regular folk.
Right. So like political professionals had developed, you know, basically a playbook for how you assess, you know, a damaging story, true or false, in all these 20th century media institutions. So, yeah, it's on page one of the newspaper. You do one thing. But if it's on page 19, maybe you hold back and you don't bring attention to it. You know what 500 points on television looks like versus 1,000 points of digital advertising. But they were, all of this sort of mindset had been shaped with these central forms of centralized media. Now we were in an era of decentralized media, which meant, one, you didn't really know immediately the reach of one of these things, who was seeing it, but you also didn't know the power of the speaker. You knew the influence of a TV station, roughly, or a newspaper, but you didn't know whether something forwarded by somebody's uncle would actually be persuasive or not. And so it was the beginning of a process that really intensified after 2016 of political professionals realizing that the way that they thought about media was too tethered to these old models and they needed to rethink it for a decentralized media age.
And nowadays, we have a much clearer sense than an email forward of virality, right? We know how many views, how many likes, shares, downloads a piece of social media is getting. And I have to assume that now factors into the calculation of what kind of response does this warrant.
Yeah. And although I think we can easily get sort of distracted by the data we do have and conclude too much from it. So like one thing worth considering is that, you know, different platforms afford different levels of insight into who's seeing it. And so, you know, I think that there's
Twitter is not the real world.
No, Twitter's not the real world, but Twitter for years gave you a relatively high level of visibility into who was sharing and engaging with material relative to other platforms. And so for disinformation researchers, both inside and outside of campaigns, there was something alluring about Twitter because you could get some sense of omniscience, what was out there. Facebook obviously got a lot of attention, but you know, you think about closed messaging apps like WhatsApp or Signal or Telegram, they are totally closed to outsiders. And so I think that one of the dangers is just looking at the places that give you the good data. And on top of that, you know, there's stuff that trends on Twitter. From the perspective of a political campaign, you don't just care that something is being seen by a lot of people. You care that it's being seen by the voters you care about. And so knowing whether those voters are in your state or your district, are these people over 18? Are they actually persuadable voters? Often that is information that traditional trending topics or whatever does not shed light on.
Another important stop on the road to sort of misinformation is you talk about the elimination of the speaker of the lie, or at least a lack of interest in its creator. So in the past, if a candidate lied about another candidate, traditionally voters would penalize them for this. But nobody's penalizing like the guy in mom's basement making like a bunch of fake claims about a candidate.
Right. They're not held accountable within the political process. And so like some of this is that if you're a political speaker, you have to report your money, the money you raise, the money you spend to election regulators. We know where television ads are placed. And there was this, you know, until very recently, just about every politician in the country feared being called a liar. And so obviously politicians have always exaggerated or shaded the truth. The reason we joke about, oh, that's such a politician's answer, is because politicians often would do a thing where they found something that was technically true, but obviously not really honest. And because they were afraid of being called a liar. The system of accountability doesn't apply to, you know, and usually the way that process worked would be if you said something, Anna, that I thought was unfair about me, I would try to get the local newspaper to write a fact check or the editorial board to scold you about it. And then I would put that in an ad saying, you know, Anna's a liar, vote for Sasha. And voters could decide whether that was important to them. Now, if the speaker is, as you say, somebody in their basement or a foreign intelligence service, they don't care what the editorial page has to say about their lies.
Yeah, I think of one of the most famous cases of where misinformation had like real world consequences that I think about recently was Pizzagate, right? I don't know if folks remember this, but it was like a fake story about this pizza shop in Washington, D.C. that was like holding children in the basement for Democrats to abuse. Totally a not true story, but a guy showed up at the shop with a gun. Like it was an actual, like there could have been violence. Thankfully, there wasn't.
Yeah. And so I think that this is, you know, it is not difficult in the last 8 years to find real world harms and damage. You know, Paul Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's husband, mm-hmm. was attacked by somebody who was a believer in QAnon, the online conspiracy theory that is sort of, you know, related to Pizzagate. January 6th grew out of people who were believers in conspiracy theories. I spent some time in Brazil reporting this. They had a kind of analogous event with you know, folks who were in denial of the election results there in early 2023. And so, you know, these are communities that are increasingly shaped and formed by online misinformation, but then become offline drivers of events. And so this is not just a matter of opinions being changed or misguided. This is coming to really fundamentally, I think, shape our politics and our, you know, the way we live.
I want to talk a little bit about voter suppression. This is one of the things that you talk about, is that misinformation is not always about putting out fake things. It's about putting out fake things to encourage people not to vote. And I want to play a clip from Giori Craig. She's the head of digital integrity at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. And here she is testifying before the U.S. House in 2022.
Research in 2020 found a website purporting to represent an organization called Protect My Vote. This so-called organization was allowed to run a digital ad campaign with more than 150 ads aiming to erode trust in mail-in voting. Some of the paid posts featured an image of LeBron James and falsely claimed he had expressed concerns about the use of mail-in voting. Facebook eventually removed the page for engaging in voter suppression tactics.
And you write in the book, actually, I think you start the book with a conversation with the Trump campaign or people who worked for the Trump campaign about similar tactics.
Yeah. So, you know, I had written a book in 2012 called The Victory Lab that was about a lot of innovation in campaigns, new data that was becoming available, the use of experiments. And it was largely a happy story about how high-tech innovation informed by cognitive science and commercial marketing and statistical modeling was making campaigns more effective about registering voters, turning them out to vote, giving them information that catered to their interests. And the reason I tell this story about the reporting on the Trump campaign in 2016, I was writing for Bloomberg Businessweek, and my colleague Josh Green and I did a few long stories about Trump's digital operation. We quoted a senior Trump campaign official talking about the three different voter suppression efforts they had underway. Those were his words. And he went through a the sort of mechanics of this. They were using something called Facebook dark posts so that they couldn't be sort of publicly visible. They were targeting them at sort of specific demographic groups that they thought could be driven not to vote at all, not to cast a ballot. And it was the first time that I had encountered it after years of reporting on this sort of area, somebody who spoke the language of the modern high-tech campaign to describe things that you could call anti-democratic. And obviously there's been in American history lots of examples of people using the court, physical force or intimidations, laws to suppress votes. Obviously, it's like a core part of American history. But I had never encountered somebody who was sort of doing it in a modern 21st century way. And that kind of awakened me to the ways in which I had probably been naive about how technological changes were going to affect our politics.
Yeah, Lie Detectives, your new book, feels like the other half of the coin. So it's sort of, you know, the victory lap is sort of the positive outlook of micro-targeting and getting better at finding your people and reaching them. And Lie Detective seems like the dark version of that, sort of the utopian dystopian view.
Yeah, I think that's about right. And I didn't really set out in either case to write the happy or sad version of our politics. But I think, you know, the Victory Lab dealt very little with the internet, because actually a lot of the innovations I was writing about were about like direct mail and door knocking and stuff. But I sent the manuscript to the printer, I think the same month that the Arab Spring began in 2011. And the story there was very similar. That the story we told ourselves was one of the internet becoming a vehicle for greater civic engagement, right? The sort of origin myth of the Arab Spring is that like one guy in Cairo puts a tweet out that says, hey, come down to Tahrir Square. And he doesn't own a, you know, state media organization. He doesn't have an established political party. But the barriers, the internet, as we just talked about, with like the barriers to entry for civic participation got lowered. And in that case, you could have a mass movement emerge in Cairo in hours or days. And what that was the happy story. And we told a similar story about the Obama campaign in 2008, right? People could go online and connect with their friends and take on campaign tasks without having to go into an office. And, you know, the Victory Lab is reckoning with the fact that you lower the barriers to entry. And yes, you get all sorts of good civic participation, but you also get all sorts of people who are able to do things in politics that they wouldn't have been able to otherwise, because high barriers meant that, you know, the person in their basement who just wants chaos or you know, the foreign spies or people who are just in it to make money off of online clicks now have that very easy access to political communication tools and none of the accountability.
I want to talk a little bit about how campaigns are trying to fight back against this. And I want to talk about the Biden campaign. You write about their big research project in the summer of 2020. So what were they trying to learn? Like, what were they doing that summer to kind of think about this misinformation?
Yeah, so the core part of it was to, look, if you are a major public figure or institution, you and the issues you care about are going to get lied about online every day. And the challenge for a political campaign, I think this is also a challenge for, you know, consumer marketers, corporations, nonprofit institutions, is to figure out which of the lies online are actually harming your strategic objectives and not get distracted by those that aren't, right? Because you can drive attention to something that's not getting a lot of attention if you choose to. That's counterproductive. The way the internet is structured, it rewards engagement. So if you try to fact check or dunk on something, you can end up driving more clicks to it, and you can just get distracted. And so the Biden campaign wanted to focus on what they called market moving disinformation. Those are the words of Rob Flaherty, who's now the deputy campaign manager, was the digital director on the campaign in the White House. The idea being the Biden campaign cared only about disinformation that was going to potentially lose Biden votes. And anything else was not their concern. And so this research project you mentioned, Anna, was to first of all identify which disinformation errors would have the biggest impact. And for example, so they asked voters, are you aware of this narrative and would it change your opinion? And they mapped these on a grid with two axes. One axis was the reach, how many persuadable voters were familiar with this. The other one was the impact, how likely it was to shift their votes. And they found, for example, that stuff related to Hunter Biden and corruption, lots of people had heard about it. But actually, very few said it would affect their vote choice. And focus groups revealed this was because they didn't see Biden as fundamentally driven by financial gain.
So not something to worry about.
It wasn't. They knew about it, but it wasn't going to change the way that they saw Biden because it just didn't resonate with existing views that they had. But the stuff about his age, what Trump was then calling Sleepy Joe, the idea that he was sort of intellectually diminished, that had a lot of reach and it did have potential impact. And in focus groups, it became clear that was not because voters were worried about his physical fitness. They saw Biden as a fundamentally weak political figure. I think that has a lot to do with having been vice president, never having been the main character of the primary process. And they worried that, as I quote one pollster, he wouldn't be the author of his presidency. And so their response to these concerns about age was not, as the communications department had been recommending, do a photo op with him on a bicycle. It was, let's put out digital videos to people who search for terms like Biden and senile on Google, where they're seeing Biden speak in an unedited way about his values. And the campaign described this fundamentally as let's stop thinking about disinformation as a supply side problem, where basically we play whack-a-mole with the latest, post or deepfake picture or conspiracy theory that emerges and respond to that. And instead see it, as they said, as a demand side problem. Why are there certain, the disinformation narratives that are going to have, that are going to hurt them are the ones that voters latch onto, and they're going to latch onto the ones that respond to existing anxieties or concerns that they have. And the campaign, instead of responding to the disinformation, should be addressing the underlying concerns.
The last thing I want to ask you about, which I find fascinating. So as somebody who's followed political campaigns for, over a decade and have gone to some of those volunteer trainings, they are now encouraging or training supporters on how to talk to their peers about issues, which is, I was so stunned by that because it's such a reversal. It has always been, do not engage. If somebody says something on abortion, you just let it go. You are not there to argue the point.
Yeah. The traditional political campaign has been this command and control operation. The campaign does tons of research, policy research, issue research, opinion research, opposition research, and then comes up with the perfect phrasing for everything and decides how and when they want to talk about it. And that's why when you, as a volunteer, go into a field office, they give you a clipboard and they say, read this script and go to the people we ask you to go to and don't freelance, right? And I think so when the internet emerged, campaigns basically translated this worldview online, and they would ask support. They basically tried to find ways to do things that they were already doing offline and do them online faster and cheaper. And so campaigns will ask you for money online. They might ask you to sign up for a volunteership. Maybe they'll ask you to share their content, but they will never ask you to communicate on their behalf. And so what happened, I think now you have this, folks who are doing this counter disinformation work are seeing that political professionals hold some responsibility for this. They created the void online by having this kind of transactional mentality. They created a lot of, I think you look back at like the Obama campaigns, which are probably the most successful online candidacy. And you can look back and you say Obama has the biggest contact list in politics, but he has a lot of very weak ties. He has a lot of people who might, open an email asking for $20, but I would argue QAnon is a stronger, deeper community than anything Obama or his supporters built. And now folks are realizing that they left the void that allows these sort of communities of disinformation to flourish. And the response to that is, let's empower our supporters at last to develop and maintain relationships on the campaign's behalf and communicate our message. And the risk will be that they say the wrong thing to the wrong person. But increasingly, that's a risk that campaigns are willing to take on so that they can sort of more organically sort of work with online networks, not against them.
That was Sasha Eisenberg, a journalist and author of a book that I definitely recommend you check out this year, The Lie Detectives, In Search of the Playbook In Search of a Playbook in the Disinformation Age. I got it out there eventually. Thank you so much
Thank
for joining
you, Anna.
Us, Sasha.
Really enjoyed it.
Coming up, we're talking about a lawsuit over local Facebook groups that ask women to answer a simple question. Are we dating the same guy? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7. NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staber, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our second story this hour is about first dates. Many people walk into them knowing a little bit about the person they're about to meet. Usually it's what they've seen on a profile, searching social media, maybe even you've casually glanced at their resume on LinkedIn. Which is why one woman, Paola Sanchez, decided to create a group called Are We Dating the Same Guy? The idea was for women to share information on Facebook that about the guys they were dating and, well, keep each other safe. Today, there are more than 200 local groups with more than 3 million members. But not everyone has had good experiences. And I'm not just talking about the guys whose pictures ended up all over these groups. Two Washington reporters, Brittany Shamus and Marissa Iatti, join us now to talk about the groups and the legal case they've created. Welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having us.
I want to start at the beginning. So about 2 years ago, Paola creates the first group after this woman in New York posts about a guy who ghosted her after a first date. Is that the origin of these groups?
I don't think we know exactly what inspired the creation of these groups, but they did pop up shortly after the West Elm Caleb phenomenon that you're talking about. There was this one guy that a lot of people online were talking about, and it generated this broader conversation about sort of the perils of online dating. And I think that created an environment where groups like this could proliferate and grow really quickly.
And single women flock to Are We Dating the Same Guy pretty quickly, and these groups like spread across the country really fast, right?
Yeah, these groups really took off. As far as we can tell, the first one popped up about 2 years ago. We think it was in New York City, and they just kind of spread like wildfire from there. It kind of seemed like it was, you know, a little grassroots movement. And pretty soon they were in, you know, almost every city, every regional area in the US, and there's some abroad as well.
Why do you think they became so popular so fast?
So we think it has a lot to do with the fact that a lot of dating has moved online at this point. In talking to sources and experts, we heard a lot about how in the past, you know, there was more vetting kind of built into the matchmaking process. You know, oftentimes you would meet somebody through your workplace or through your best friend or through your mom. And because of that, there was some accountability just sort of naturally built in there. You know, like if I'm introducing you to this great person for you to potentially date, like they have sort of an incentive to treat you nicely. But now we're in this era where online dating is kind of the primary means through which people meet. And so they're kind of going in blind. Like maybe they know the person's name, their age, you know, whatever they fill out in a dating app, but it's not a lot of information.
So how do these groups work? When you join the community, I assume you're asked to agree to certain standards of behavior, like any other sort of Facebook group, right?
Yeah, you're asked to agree to a list of rules that are meant to keep the groups true to their stated purpose. And the purpose is to essentially warn other women about bad behavior by men, the most serious of which it would be things like abuse, harassment, assault. And the rules ask you to not, say, attack a guy's physical appearance, to not be mean, basically, that these groups are really meant to protect women and keep them safe. And so a lot of the posts in the groups follow sort of a pattern where somebody will post a photo of a man from a dating app, and they'll ask for what they call red flags or T, which basically means any warnings about this guy. And people will weigh in the comments with whatever they know.
And sometimes it might be positive, like, I know him, he's great, right? It's not always awful.
More often than not, it's negative. That's true that occasionally you'll get somebody who will say, oh, this is my friend. He's great. Or sometimes people will react like purely to the photo and say like, oh, let me know if it doesn't work out. You know, that's a good looking guy. Or on the other hand, sometimes they will react negatively to the photo. So it's like a real range. But I would say what we've seen is like oftentimes it's not positive.
And even when it's not positive, sometimes I guess we might call that a positive. I'm going to get tripped up on the words there. But I want to talk about some of the things that women have said the group did for them that was good before we get into some of the negative impacts. So these groups have led people to realize they are dating the same guy. And while that does suck, one could argue that it's better to know earlier rather than later.
Yeah, there have been women who posted in the groups and said, these groups really helped me, that I was about to go into what seemed like maybe it could have been a dangerous situation. And I saw someone's warning in here and I didn't go on the date. And I'm really glad I didn't. We spoke to somebody who found out in one of the groups that her boyfriend was cheating on her and broke up with him and is glad that she got that information. So in a lot of situations, the groups do work as intended and do tell women the information they're looking for about the men they're dating.
And they're intended to be secret. Essentially, what happens within the group is supposed to stay within the group, but you can, Facebook allows screenshots, so you can screenshot the conversations. And sometimes they leak, and it can be bad for the women who posted them. Can you tell us about Shannon Hyatt? Hyatt, I hope I'm saying that correct.
Yeah, Shannon was 29 and living in Columbus, Ohio. She posted in one of the groups about her ex. She accused him of stealing medication and money from her. And a few days later, she was found dead in her home. She had been stabbed to death. Her ex is charged with killing her. It's important to know that she did not post only in the Are We Dating the Same Guy group. She posted in a few other places, including on her personal Facebook page. But prosecutors have said that the ex, in talking about what he's accused of doing, said he was upset by her comments on social media about him. So again, we don't know which comments he may have seen, but she did post in these groups, and we think that it demonstrates the stakes of posting on the internet, where you don't quite know who is going to end up seeing or hearing about your comments.
And you talked to another young woman named Jocelyn, whose last name was not used. And her seems a pretty direct line, right? She posted in one of these groups, it was somehow shared with her ex, and then he got in contact with her.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Jocelyn had essentially just extracted herself from a relationship that she describes as being very abusive, and really made an effort to put some space between herself and her ex, even like moving away, breaking off contact with him. And she essentially came to these groups because she was looking for support. Like, she was still kind of blaming herself for what went wrong, and she was looking for sort of an outlet, someplace where she could find support. She posted in the group, and she ended up having him kind of like burst back into her life, texting her, you know, like relitigating things, threatening to sue her, and just, you know, sort of bursting back into her life in a way that was scary to her.
Because the rules of secrecy, this, you know, the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club, but it only works if people follow the rules. So I want to know, in your reporting, how do moderators in these groups respond to women who say their leaked posts have put them in danger?
What we have been told is that moderators don't do a whole lot. They might ask if the woman knows who leaked. They might, if they can get some proof of who leaked it, they might kick that person out of the groups, but there's not a lot of response. One of the former moderators we talked to said there was no discussion with in training materials or anything like that about what to do if they were specifically told by a woman, you know, my message got back to the guy I wrote about, I specifically feel like I'm in danger. They just weren't trained to handle that.
And the other thing that happens is when it gets back to the guy, sometimes the guy is really upset. You wrote about a guy who was accused of being intimate with his dog and then thought he was recognized in a bookstore.
Yeah, one thing that we heard over and over again in talking to people for this story was just like how deeply impactful some of the things that are said in these groups can be in people's lives. And the man that you're talking about, we weren't able to name him, but in his case, he was just like completely horrified by this allegation, you know, for obvious reasons. And he said it like really sent him down an emotional spiral where he just felt like, I'm never going to be able to get away from this horrible thing that has been said about me, and described being in a bookstore with his mom, actually, and becoming convinced that these women were comparing his appearance to like a photo from the group, and thinking about like, this is the guy with the dogs, you know, just the harm of that kind of rumor being spread about you without being able to address it.
So one guy from Illinois has taken legal action. What do we know about him and the lawsuit that he's filed against Paolo Sanchez, Facebook, and like a number of other folks?
Yeah, that that lawsuit stood out because he did name Paola and Meta, which is the parent company of Facebook. It was filed in January. It was quickly dismissed for procedural reasons and refiled. So that's still in the works. Initially, when it was filed, we talked to a few legal experts who called it a long shot. But we'll see where it goes. Defamation cases are hard to prove, but it could be an interesting test case.
And he's essentially alleging that the information shared about him in these groups was not accurate. And you know, we talked a little bit about the dog guy and this lawsuit, but there are guys who claim they've lost jobs, relationships, right? There seems to be a lot of fallout if you end up on the wrong end of one of these groups.
Yeah, we heard stories from men about, you know, people broke up with them because of what was said in these groups, which the men, they insist these things were not true. We've heard about the things that were said being brought up in their workplaces. You know, they describe being like questioned about it. They also talked about just the sort of mental impact of, you know, knowing people are talking about you in this way and you can't, you know, defend yourself. And these groups are so big, like they can be up to 100,000 people or more, kind of like the size of a city. And so to have this belief that, you know, all the women in your community think this thing about you that you say isn't true, is a heavy burden.
You weren't able to interview Ms. Sanchez, but I understand that she is potentially working on an app that would prohibit screenshots going forward. Is that correct?
Yeah, she has raised money through a GoFundMe that she says is meant to build this app. And there is an app in beta testing. And she says the point of this is to eliminate some of what people complain about with the Facebook groups. It is meant to, as you said, prevent screenshots. It also, I believe, would not, it would allow anonymous commenting. And so the idea from her perspective is to make these groups a little bit more secure.
That was Brittany Shamus, a reporter with The Washington Post, and Marissa Iatti, also a reporter with The Washington Post. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking about the lawsuit against Apple. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staber, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Here to tell us about a few different topics is Russell Holly, Managing Editor for Commerce and CNET. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So I want to start with the Apple lawsuit. So the U.S. Justice Department is taking on Apple for allegations that it is a monopoly when it comes to its sort of landmark product, the iPhone. Can you kind of walk us through what they're alleging here?
Yeah, so on a high level, the accusation being levied against Apple right now is that the company has created a product where it completely owns the hardware, it completely owns the software, and it completely owns the place where you can buy and sell things that go on that device. All of which is technically true, but the issues that are brought in each one of those layers are the ways in which that software and that experience has been built to deter someone from switching from one platform to another. So if you've been using an iPhone for a little while and you don't like it, it can be quite difficult to move to another platform. And the allegation being made here is that is not something that has to exist and that it is an intentional decision that Apple has made.
So one of the examples in the lawsuit is Apple's wallet. This is where you can upload your card and you can just like stick your phone out and pay. Lots of people love it. But Apple doesn't allow you to have another party, like a non-Apple wallet on your phone. And the idea is then you just get used to Apple wallet and you can't take that wallet with you if you decide to become an Android phone person.
That's exactly right. It requires an entirely different setup. And, you know, the technology around wireless payment is an open platform. There are lots of different ways in which you can transmit, you know, that bits of technology using other things. But Apple is very specific about only using its set of tools in order to make that happen. There was originally some arguments around this being a security and privacy function where Apple could oversee all of the different things that that go into it. But the underlying technology is built, very nearly identically to the way that not only Google, but Microsoft and other companies have built, very similar payment platforms.
There's also an allegation that when it comes to the Apple Watch, so the Apple Watch allows you to respond to messages. It's a great feature, but it's not really possible if you get like a Garmin or another kind of watch. So it's essentially that like other smartwatches don't pair as well with the iPhone as the Apple Watch. And the argument is that's by design, right?
That's exactly right. There isn't a technical reason why a watch made by Garmin or the company previously known as Fitbit, there's no technical reason why those devices couldn't have the same level of functionality as an Apple Watch on the on your iPhone or when communicating with your iPhone. In fact, there are several people that I have met who keep an iPad around specifically so that they can use an Apple Watch, even though they have an Android phone, because that regular sync back through that platform can be done through the iPad once a day.
That sounds complicated.
It very much is.
And so this is not the first time that the U.S. government has sued a company. They've sued Meta. They've sued Microsoft pretty famously. And they even went after Amazon for squeezing third-party merchants who use their site. So this is like the DOJ taking on what they consider illegally maintained monopolies. This is not a new thing.
That's exactly right. And if you hear legal experts speak on this topic, one of the things that gets pointed out pretty quickly is that the structure of this lawsuit is very similar to the one that the Department of Justice filed against Microsoft when it was considered a monopoly for very similar, kind of descriptions of how it is that its software functions and how it interacts with other tools across an ecosystem. So this is, what you'll probably see over the next couple of weeks are a lot of stories about Apple Messages and how, green, bubbles versus blue bubbles. But really, when you kind of take a step back from some of the kind of sillier points of this, the underlying case that's being made here is not that Apple has built a superior set of products for its users, but that in building those products, it actually added specifically complications to make it so that only the Apple experience, you know, as consumed by having as many Apple products as possible, is how you get to those that experience.
Now, I guess the argument from Apple, or one of the arguments that I hear out there being made, is that Apple is one of the most valuable companies on the planet. And this is one of the iPhone is probably their most valuable product. Is there any concern that the DOJ taking them on in this way would be bad for the economy?
That is a really great question. You know, I don't know that a bad for the economy is something that would apply here if the legal ramifications of this were that Apple needed to open up its, you know, software to allow other companies to come in and do things. It would certainly decrease the number of requirements for adding on different pieces of hardware. It's worth pointing out that the average person who owns an iPhone only owns one or two other Apple products to communicate with. And that is really just, you know, it's usually an iPad or an Apple Watch or maybe a MacBook, but usually not the entire ecosystem, you know, and it's specifically because Apple's products tend to be a little more expensive. The upkeep on them tends to be, you know, kind of a little bit more. It is, you know, it is true that Apple would likely not make as much money in the way that this is set up. But as far as the economy as a whole, it's not like consumers are going to stop buying things that connect to the iPhone. It would just be not Apple things.
Right, which is something Apple may not like the idea of very much.
Correct.
Let's shift our conversation to sunglasses. So my dad used to have these flip lenses that attached to your regular glasses. And, you know, you could flip them up and down when the sun was out or when you were driving. And I used to tease him mercilessly about them. But as I've gotten older and I wear my glasses more and more, I find myself driving with a pair of sunglasses over top of my regular glasses. Now, it's a super interesting look. I definitely have gotten a few laughs from drive-through baristas when I forget to take the sunglasses off. So I'm hoping you're about to tell me that there is an alternative to this double glass or flip glass conundrum.
In fact, there are several options available, but the one that I found really, really interesting is a company named 32 Degrees North is making a set of glasses. They released a prototype of a set of glasses last year that had this touch panel on the side of the glasses. And when you swiped, it darkened automatically the lens that you had. It was using electrochromatic tech. It's basically a really thin layer of LCD display on top of corrective lenses that made it so that when you swiped, it darkened. I'm personally a fan of this over the widely available transitions lenses, because transitions lenses don't tend to transition as quickly as I would prefer them. And I end up walking around in the dark sometimes for longer than I feel is necessary. But what makes this new set that 32 Degrees North has made more interesting is that in addition to being able to control, you know, how your glasses tint, you can also use them as though they are reading glasses for when you are up close. In fact, the liquid crystal display that is on these lenses will change your prescription if you swipe in a specific pattern to zoom in on text or to, you know, to make things that are closer clearer. And I find that fascinating.
So instead of pulling out a pair of readers at the restaurant, you just kind of like covertly tap your glasses.
That's exactly right. A quick swipe on an otherwise ordinary looking pair of glasses would make it so that you can now see, you know, quite clearly something that is in front of you. And when you're back to having that conversation with the person across the table, you can swipe again and that person would then come into focus as though it was, you know, kind of a different set of glasses that you would put on. You don't have to worry about there being like a line in the middle of the glasses so that you're kind of looking down through one side and up like you would with progressives. And you have a greater control over the different levels of kind of zooming in and out over this than you would through what are called digital progressives, where it kind of gradually transitions from one magnification to another in several glasses. It gives you a fair bit of flexibility.
So what do they cost?
These are not inexpensive. These are $850 glasses. It's worth pointing out that this is the first generation of this to have ever been made, and this is kind of the only company making a version of this right now. So it's expected that the cost of something like this will go down precipitously over the next couple of years. But that this is something that is a consumer product that is available right now is really kind of fascinating.
And probably not covered by your health insurance yet.
I would say all of it is likely not covered by your health insurance yet. But this is something, again, that, you know, as costs go down with tech like this, is likely something that we'll see a whole lot more of.
It's definitely fascinating, the idea of just being able to swipe and control, because I agree with you on the transition lenses. They don't work quite the way I would want them to.
Yeah, and there have been versions of this where, you know, it's you know, got a battery built into the glasses, but it's a real small battery, and it's just enough to deliver that electric charge to kind of darken or brighten the glasses. There are some versions that'll give you, you know, kind of degrees of darkening that you can apply to your lenses, whereas this one appears to be kind of an on and off. But you know, the way that this tech works largely is that the glasses that you're using, you know, the actual lenses are themselves a form of liquid crystal display. So it's almost like you've got liquid, you know, kind of lenses going in front of you, making all of these changes.
So wild. Last but not least, I want to talk about the new SAG-AFTRA contract for voice actors, and this. Centers, I mean, I know we're talking about Hollywood and actors and contracts, but a big sticking point was how artificial intelligence was going to be used in television, in movies, in commercials. So what's the deal here?
Yeah, so a big part of the original SAG-AFTRA agreement with AI protections, a lot of the folks who were involved in that process said that it felt incomplete. And it felt incomplete in particular to voice actors, which applied to people who read audiobooks for Audible and other places, but also any kind of animated project that would ordinarily be covered by SAG-AFTRA did not have these, you know, kind of defined AI protections. And a big part of what was being asked for by the folks involved was for a voice actor to be clearly defined as a human being and not something that could be automatically generated by a voice control. If you scroll through pretty much any social media app right now, there are some really clever generative AI programs that you can pay, you know, $8 a month or something for, that will listen to your voice for a couple of seconds and then use your voice or a model of your voice that had been created to sing popular songs back to you and, you know, kind of do silly things like that, which seems like a really fun idea until you think about how very quickly that could be used to replace someone's job for reading an audiobook or delivering lines for a kid's show. And so those protections were something that were previously missing, and as of late last week, were added into an update to that contract.
Yeah, it's we had a show a couple weeks ago with a journalist who was talking about people who are in the media more. So like you and I, who do this on a regular basis, it is very easy to capture our voices, like clean audio of our voices, and then create like an AI version of us.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when it comes to, you know, people of importance, you know, senators and Congress folks and, you know, celebrities and things like that, you know, being able to capture even just moments of that audio is often all that some of these generative AI prompts need, is a few seconds of audio in order to build a model that is pretty close. Which is a big part of why you don't see companies like OpenAI, you know, doing things that would encourage the creation of celebrity deepfake voices. But a lot of those tools still exist. They're just not being controlled by some of the larger players in the space right now.
So they reached a deal. What is the agreement here? Are there going to be AI voices?
There are not going to be AI voices for anything that is clearly defined as a role to be spoken. So if a script is written and you know, someone has to come in and deliver lines for something, the current contract clearly defines that a human being must be the person to deliver those lines in order to fulfill the SAG-AFTRA agreement. Where this doesn't cover are things like sound effects, which is a different, you know, kind of organization, a different union contract that would have to be created and you know, could very well be created, but for the purposes of spoken word by humans, it will be done so by humans for quite a while now, as this contract is likely going to last for at least the next 2 years.
Final question is a wild card. We have a listener who wrote us and had a tech question for you, so I'm going to throw it at you. Unprepared. Bill from Clintonville wanted advice that he puts all his passwords in Excel on his laptop, and he wanted to know if this was a good way to save all his different passwords.
So I didn't answer right away because I think my heart fluttered slightly as I heard everything that was just said there. No, this is not the preferred way of storing all of your passwords. There are, Excel does not do anything to protect those passwords. So anybody can walk by and open that file and see, hey, these are these passwords. It doesn't really, you know, someone has to know exactly where that file is and be able to access it. But for your convenience, there are tools like 1Password, which don't cost much, if anything at all, and allow you to store passwords in a way that you can still access from either your phone or your laptop or something like that. And do so safely, such that somebody else could come along and grab your phone and still not be able to access those passwords because it would require a fingerprint or a face unlock or something like that in order to access those files. So I would recommend using something that encrypts those passwords for your own protection and not Excel.
That was Russell Holly, managing editor for CNET. Thank you.